The Bacchae by Euripides. As long as human beings have been self-aware, and just when that occurred in human history is a fascinating subject for study and discussion, they have speculated about the meaning of life. Through science, humans have subjected all experience to rigorous, self-correcting study. But the sciences do not deal with the ultimates of life. Where science ends, philosophy begins, seeking to find meaning and purpose in our existence. Religion is also concerned with ultimate answers, but seeks them from divine revelation, especially from sacred texts which have been accumulated over time, the Torah, the Gospels, the Quran, and sacred writing of India and the Orient. These religious sources stand apart from science and do not depend on objective study. But apart from science and religion, there is a third way to deal with ultimate questions, and that is tragedy. Now, we use the term to mean something sad or horrific, but that is just an aspect of tragedy. The term actually means a kind of traversal or journey in search of truth, an illustration of some aspect of life's meaning. A tragedy usually involves a person of exceptional ability who sets out to achieve a goal and never deviates from it, seeing it right through to its conclusion. The audience is invited to watch the process and draw personal conclusions from it. Euripides' The Bacchae examines one of the major ethical debates of the 5th century BCE, the conflict between nomos and physis. Now, what follows is adapted in part from an article by classicist Charles Siegel. And don't be put off by these terms, nomos and physis. Nomos means law or custom, and that stands for social practices and established institutions. The play concerns the attempt to bring Dionysian worship safely into the realm of accepted custom. Physis, which means roughly nature, refers to those instincts, appetites, and demands of the body which are kept in check by nomos. It could be argued that nomos is an artificial restraint on something more basic than human institutions. Physis includes aspects of the natural world beyond human control, not made by human design, but to which humans may be subject. Now, nomos is used to keep these aggressive, dangerous traits under control and make orderly society possible. If everyone lived by the instinctual impulses we all share with animals, what we call civilization would be impossible. In the play, Pentheus attempts to ban what he considers a dangerous religious rite for the good of the community. In doing so, he unwittingly unleashes its deeper, more dangerous characteristics. Because religious ecstasy, when placed under constraint, may erupt in dangerous, even disastrous ways. Now, the nomos-physis dichotomy is just one aspect of this fascinating play, but it offers, perhaps, the most fruitful material for discussion. The end result of the actions of both Dionysus and Pentheus bring death and social upheaval to the city of Thebes. The god is no better than the man in this regard. Religion can be as savage in its expression as human institutions. Dionysus may be viewed as the god of letting go. Again and again in the play, he is cited as the releaser, one who liberates humans from the mundane restraints of life through wine, singing, dancing, and the illusion-producing power of the mask and theater. But to what extent may one release oneself from the safety of those rules and conventions which constitute an orderly and balanced society. How much of one should we give up for the other? As do all tragedies, the Bacchae elicits these and other thoughts, which is why watching and contemplating such plays helps us come to an understanding of what it means to be human. The play itself is a frightening study of the beauty and horror of religious ecstasy. It sets in opposition life in nature and life in a cosmopolitan setting. It prompts the question of what lies beneath the constraints of civilization, and what good and painful things can happen when we free ourselves from those constraints. It also presents an ancient view of the gods as coldly indifferent to the sufferings of humanity, jealous of their prerogatives, and unspeakably cruel in their punishments. It has been said that none of the characters in this play, divine or human, come off well. Some commentators consider this work Euripides' savage, embittered valedictory to the world as he saw it. Now to the play itself. The god Dionysus begins the play's prologue in the shape of a handsome young man. He announces that he has come to introduce his worship and rites to Thebes, the city and land of his mother Semele. He tells of his conception by Zeus, the father of the gods, and how Semele tricked Zeus into revealing himself. The sight of the god destroyed her, but the unborn baby was saved and placed in his father's thigh, from whence he was born. Thebes is currently ruled by Pentheus, son of Agave, who is sister to Semele. Pentheus received his authority from Cadmus, father of Semele and Agave. Dionysus makes it clear that Pentheus must accept his worship, and he summons his followers, women of Asia, to enter the city and assist him. The chorus dances in, singing a hymn to Bacchus, another name for Dionysus, detailing his attributes and the service due to him. Scene 1 introduces Cadmus, the former ruler of Thebes, and the aged hermaphroditic prophet Tiresias. Both have dressed in fawn skins in order to join in the Bacchic rites outside city walls. Pentheus enters and scolds the two old men for their foolishness, declaring that the story of Semele giving birth to a god is a fiction. He is furious that his mother has also joined the Bacchants. Tiresias lectures Pentheus on the need to give all the gods their due, but the young king has decided to have the man who is preaching this new religion, actually Dionysus in disguise, arrested. The chorus then sings Ode 1, which warns that Pentheus' behavior is wrong and dangerous. They end with further praise of Dionysus. In Scene 2, the disguised Dionysus is brought before Pentheus in chains. After a fruitless argument, Pentheus sends Dionysus to prison. In Ode 2, the chorus again praises Dionysus and gives ominous hints of the danger in which Pentheus has placed himself. An earthquake opens Scene 3, and Dionysus walks out of the palace, free and unfettered. He tells the chorus how easily he deceived his captors and walked to freedom. Pentheus comes racing from the palace, furious and upset. He sees Dionysus and threatens him again. But a messenger interrupts. He has come from the slopes of Mount Kithaeron, where he has seen women in their Bacchic rites. At first, the crowd was peaceful, causing milk and honey to gush from the ground, suckling young animals as if they were babes. But some men, observing the rites, decided to capture Agave and return her to the king. At this point, the women went wild, tearing apart with their bare hands all living things they encountered. The messenger escaped to bring the king this fearful news. It is worth interrupting at this point to emphasize that these Bacchic rites of wild orgiastic ecstasy had nothing to do with sex. That's what modern audiences would assume, but Euripides goes out of his way to demonstrate otherwise. Well, Pentheus decides to summon his army and move against the women. But Dionysus stops him with a temptation. How would he like to spy on the women in their revels? Pentheus succumbs and goes into the palace. Dionysus follows to effect the king's transformation. The chorus then speaks of wisdom and submission to the gods in Ode 3. Scene 4 opens with Dionysus summoning Pentheus from the palace. He has dressed the king in a gown and made him up to look like a woman. He then leads the submissive king off to witness the revels. The chorus cries out for vengeance in Ode 4. A second messenger enters in Scene 5 to tell of the king's fate. In order that Pentheus might see better, Dionysus bends a tall tree to the ground and sets the king upon it. As he rises up into the air, he is spied by the women, who charge him and bring him to the ground, where his mother, Agave, tears him apart with her bare hands, thinking it is some beast she has killed. She is returning to the city with Pentheus' head impaled on a thyrsus, a rod covered with ivy. The chorus exults in their victory over Pentheus in Ode 5. Agave enters, bearing her trophy, calling on the women to celebrate with her. Cadmos follows with the gathered remnants of his grandson's body. Slowly, he brings Agave out of her trance. When she sees Pentheus' head, she screams in terror. Dionysus then appears on top of the palace and orders Agave to leave the city. He tells Cadmos that he and his wife, the goddess Harmony, will be turned into serpents and driven forth as well. But they will be redeemed by the god Ares, Harmony's father, later on. Cadmos pleads for mercy, but Dionysus is unmoved. I am a god. You have offended me. The chorus leaves the stage, singing of the gods' mysterious ways. A note about Euripides. Euripides was born between 480 and 484 BCE, most probably on the island of Salamis. He was the son of Musarchus, or Musarchides, and grew up in a well-to-do family. It's likely that his mother was of a prominent family. Aristophanes' joke that she was a green grocer was funny because it was so far off the mark. Little is known of his life, apart from the fact that he began his professional career as a painter. He was moderate in his views, but did not take an active part in public life, as did Aeschylus and Sophocles. Commentators speculate that he was morose, and deduced from his plays that he was a misogynist. Now, those are simply guesses. We rather admire him for the prominent role he gives to women in his plays. His contemporaries thought it scandalous. Certainly he was interested in philosophy and the issues of his day. Although from the same period as Sophocles, his tragedies seem to be from a different age. His plays focus on individuals, ideas, and passions, rather than on community. During his lifetime, he aroused great interest and great opposition. In 408 BC, he visited the court of Archelaus, king of Macedon, and died there around 406 or 407 BCE. Sophocles is said to have dressed the chorus of his next play in mourning as a tribute. Euripides was the third of the classic Greek playwrights and author of some 90 dramas, only 19 complete scripts of which survive. Little regarded in his lifetime, he became extraordinarily popular after his death, and his plays were often revived. At the beginning of his career, he wrote formal tragedies, but gradually his stories evolved into what we might call hybrid forms. While his plots were popular and exciting, he sometimes achieved his effects at the cost of consistent character development. He devised involving stories, but often solved them quickly by having a god intervene at the end of the play. The term for this is deus ex machina, a Latin phrase meaning literally the god from the machine. This comes of the practice in Greek theater of having the god appear above the building at the rear of the stage area and coming down in some kind of a hoist. He was awarded first prize only 5 times, the last coming after his death. This final prize was for the Bacchae. There's a list of Euripides' surviving plays in the text. You might note the sequence of plays beginning with Hecuba and ending with Iphigenia and Tauris. These 7 plays were part of a complete collection of Euripides' works and have survived by chance. Over the years, the bulk of classic dramas have been lost in the burning of great libraries and the loss of personal collections through the accidents and ravages of time. It is almost miraculous that we have the few copies which remain. One of the most hopeful prospects for discovering additional texts is in the exhumation of graves in Egypt. Papyrus texts were often used in the mummification of commoners, and as they have been examined by archaeologists, some surprising discoveries have been made. For example, the only complete copy we have of a play by the Greek writer Menander, who had a profound influence on Roman and Elizabethan playwrights, was taken from an Egyptian corpse in modern times.